Hello, Sales Change listeners. This is the season finale of the Sales Change podcast. We are taking a break over the summer period and we will return to your ears on Monday, the 14th of September with a brand new season premiere. More about that in the Sales Change newsletter. Visit www.saleschange.co.uk/newsletter. Sign up and get some information. But I've literally just finished the recording with Will Ferreira of Social Buff. He's our guest on the season finale. We're going to have a chat about Social Buff, COVID-19, obviously. We hear about why Will doesn't like natural hierarchy within companies. It just doesn't fit with his ethos. Will's recording from Holland. His agency is based between Holland and London. How does he manage a team of six people across two different countries? We find out in the podcast. And Will also answers the Sales Change 5 questions. Remember, visit Instagram. It's at Sales Change. Click a follow. I'll see you there. Enjoy the episode. Hello, Will. Welcome to the season finale of the Sales Change podcast. This is season one finale. How are you, my friend?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me as well. I've been looking forward to this.
It's been a pain trying to organise it, hasn't it, with both of our schedules?
It has. I've been a bit terrible with my schedule, so I do apologise. But we're finally here after 4th attempt, I think.
Where are you at the moment?
I'm in Amsterdam, so I literally arrived an hour ago and we took the overnight ferry, drove over, which was an experience and a half. Never done it before. And I was living in London until COVID-19, and then moved out of my apartment in London, and my lease ended while I was staying with family in Hertfordshire. So I decided that longer term, for the summer until September, it would be better off making my way over here and spending some time with my family out here. So I love the city and it's home for me. My family's been here for 14 years. Some of my team are here as well. So it's a bit of...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, nice work-life balance here.
But we'll get onto how you can split international business a little bit later. But how's things with the COVID-19 situation for you?
Yeah, I mean, personally, to be honest, I actually saw this as a great opportunity to really focus and double down on myself and kind of invest a little bit more time in my personal mental and physical health, which was great. Spend more time with family and actually have, you know, real conversations and kind of slow down a bit. So I actually really enjoyed this. And I guess I'm a lucky one because my business is predominantly set up for remote working. So that wasn't a stress. And we've actually done really well given the circumstances because everyone is needing our services in digital marketing. So we've been very lucky, very, very lucky.
Tell me about your business, Will.
Yeah, so I'm the co-founder of a digital marketing agency called Social Buff. Social Buff was actually launched in late 2018, and then I came on board as kind of a late co-founder to my co-founder, Aaron Spencer Higgins, who was running it in, I think it was about February, March time when I came on board officially last year. And it was just the two of us starting out. Previously, we've both owned businesses, agencies, as well as a tech brand. So we kind of just wanted to build a kind of performance-led team that could really help scale businesses and kind of be a growth partner to those founders and entrepreneurs and challenger brands. And over the last year, we've had a great run working with global brands and helping them build out new kind of digital innovation solutions for kind of social commerce and building out direct consumer models for them, mainly in the FMCG space. And we've also been working with new ventures as well as kind of starting to invest in our own ventures that we want to take to market. And the idea behind Social Buff is it's really an engine for growth for anything D2C. So we've built out our specialist team and we're now kind of getting to a stage where we can plug in any brand that we want to work with to that team and help them scale through our services.
How many have you got in your team?
So there's 5 of us full-time, and there's another 5 kind of contracted on a monthly rolling basis. Yeah. So our internal team is mainly kind of client-facing team, strategy team, and we also have one in-house creative. And then the additional team is external talent, mainly in web and app design development. So we do foundational work to some of our client campaigns and projects. So building out e-commerce experiences or building out direct consumer solutions then launching what is a monthly management retainer where we actually scale them through our marketing and drive a return of investment. So we kind of manage the whole experience, but we outsource the technical bits that we don't do in-house.
Why did you join Social Buff?
That's
a good question.
Yeah, good question. So I set up an agency out of university, which was based in Bournemouth. And It was just a creative agency. Me and a friend of mine from school set it up, and I was the acting MD. He was the creative director, and we had a really good run. We ran it for 3 years together, scaled it to a 20-man team, six figures in profit in 3 years. And really, that was my first run at entrepreneurship, but the lifestyle wasn't what I was looking for. I very much wanted to travel and experience different kind of companies, cultures, and work with different people in many different ways. And the direction the company was going, I was going to spend the next 10 years in Bournemouth. And for me, someone who never grew up there, it was very different from the people who we...
Where are you from originally?
It's a bit of a long-winded answer, to be honest. My parents are expats. I was actually born in Taiwan. My dad worked for Ally Domecq, the drinks distribution company.
Okay.
So we were based out in Hong Kong, Philippines, Singapore, and Taiwan. And then my parents divorced in about 2000, and I moved to the UK with my mum, and my dad stayed in Asia, and then eventually moved to Amsterdam. So I spent quite a lot of my time kind of dossing around the place, and then in the UK, made my way up from Essex to Hampshire to Dorset, and then studied in Brighton. So I kind of dotted around
Eclectic.
Everywhere. Yeah. And then when we launched my first company, I then moved to Bournemouth because that's where my co-founder lived, and that's where kind of our network
was. Did you go
to
university in Bournemouth?
Yeah. So I studied, I actually went to film school. I didn't actually go to proper university, but I went to a private film school, wanted to be a film director. And yeah, really just starting my adventure was not based upon wanting to own my own business or be an entrepreneur. It was more... Actually, I saw an opportunity to connect creatives to paid work and connect brands to talent. And that's kind of how the agency was built. And when I was at film school, I wanted to branch out of just film. So I worked in agencies or in brands in everything from advertising, marketing, production, to just get wider experience and just learn more about the different avenues film could take me.
Yeah.
So I kind of collected all that knowledge and then I guess became a bit of a network connector. And that's how the agency was born. And then... Going back to your original question of why I joined Social Buff, I took an exit from my first company in late 2017, spent a year as a consultant. And one of the things that I noticed was I came from a traditional agency background, so it was more creative led. And I noticed that there was a big move in performance, or the requirement of performance from influencer marketing to paid advertising on especially social.
Do you think that's still the case now?
I think it's shifting slightly. I think we still drive huge amounts of results just through paid social.
Yeah.
And a lot of the ROI that we do deliver is through paid social, but there's so much more to it these days. I think a lot of people look at the kind of the end result of, oh, you guys do paid social, that's how you deliver the results. But actually, it's a foundational work that we do for a brand, you know, digital transformation, brand transformation, ensuring that they're building, you know, brand and consumer retention and building exposure in a creative way with really strong messaging.
It's building that trust, building the trust in the audience that you're trying to attract, and then using paid ads to then grow that audience once you've got the base foundation there.
Exactly. And it's just bridging the gap. You know, the problem a lot of brands face is they say, okay, we want paid social to drive sales. And then we tell them that actually they need to look at their foundations first. And there's a lot of kind of transformational stuff that we analyze needs to be done. So a lot of it, I guess, are what you don't see is the behind the scenes stuff of having to set those right foundations and get a right strategy in place to build that brand. And then taking it to what we call kind of market amplification, where we obviously bridge the gap between brand and consumer when the brand is sitting right for that consumer, instead of taking a brand to consumers that consumers can't relate to.
Do you think brands see paid social ads as a magic pill?
I definitely think there's a mix. We see especially smaller businesses, it's a godsend. In some cases, you know, lead generation and e-commerce sales are one of the core things we drive as a business for the clients we work for. And for the smaller business, lead generation is, you know, unbelievably effective through paid social. And we're able to scale businesses just through that. And sometimes it doesn't need the foundational work. But if we speak to a brand that believes that they obviously are very well polished and perfect, and they want the secret sauce to scaling their business and generating more revenue, normally they think that's just, you know, turning on paid social. And a lot of time we experience it, they try and do it themselves. And again, it's everyone has a very top line perspective instead of actually understanding the depths and the skill set that you need to be able to really drive results, but not only quick results, but build sustainable business growth, which I think a lot of people throw out the window when it comes to, I guess, customer acquisition based marketing. They want quicker results, and they want some to see change within even a couple of weeks in some occasions, where us as a business, we actually want to say, okay, let's align with your commercial and sales goals. Where do you want to be in 2 years' time? How can we be a part of that journey and actually grow it more sustainably instead of just make you a lot of money in 2 months, but then the well's empty. We can't keep obviously dipping into the same pool of people, and we've got to build obviously brand association and build culture around what we're trying to achieve for a company. And sadly, some of the brands we speak to don't have that perspective or that understanding. So there's a lot of educational aspect to what we do as well.
So once you've built the foundations of a brand and you've built that trust with the audience, what's the next stage for you? Have you got is it a process that you go through at Social Buff that you go from point A to point B in order to then generate some sales coming in the front door?
Yeah, so it's definitely, I guess the first stage is always technical foundations, implementing an e-commerce experience or building out, you know, an app solution maybe, and really building the technical aspect of the company and how the business needs to operate in order to scale. Then we look at the brand and the creative of the brand and how it communicates with audiences. So that's kind of phase two, ensuring that we've got clear messaging and we kind of are seen and heard above the noise through our content and creativity. And then three is kind of like brand association. So influencer marketing, traditional press and PR, paid media. And then four is then scaling. So then taking that and amplifying that through very obviously focused campaigns that are ROI driven, as in, you know, mainly paid social, Google ads. Those are kind of the two most effective areas that we're seeing where we can really drive serious results in terms of sales for a client.
Yeah, yeah. How do you find managing the team internationally? Because like you said at the start of this, your business is very well set up to remote work. So have you seen any changes over the last couple of weeks, months?
Yeah, going into Social Buff, I wanted to ensure that actually I was implementing some sort of a lifestyle business around the company structure. And I think when obviously me and Aaron started Social Buff together, it was just us and our laptops, and we kind of scaled the team, and the talent wasn't in one place. So naturally I had contacts in Amsterdam. I had contacts. We have one contractor that works for us in Rome. It was more a case of building a brand around the talent instead of the other way around. And my previous agency, I spent my 9-to-5 managing people in one office, and I actually wasn't getting any work done. I felt that if we found the right talent who we could empower and motivate to have a self kind of managed position in the company where they have a little bit more responsibility, they have less kind of authority and kind of routine and structure to their day to day, and they're kind of empowered to manage their roles themselves, we actually see performance perform a lot better. So This kind of last 3 months, actually, the only difference we've seen is actually people being more and more productive because they are so bought into the business survival and business growth as well. When COVID hit and we had a very serious conversation with the team, you know, everyone weighed in to make sure that we're in a really strong position coming out of it. So really, I've just seen this whole situation mean that the team has come closer together in terms of building the relationship with each other. And as a small team, it's more like a family anyway. So we all have, you know, the company's interests at heart.
a previous guest that we've had on, Will St. James. I think you know William, or you've heard of Will. Both Will and Joe, the directors of the company, came on and I asked them where they wanted their creative agency to go in the next couple of years. And they had a limit on the amount of people that they wanted to employ. Now, you said in your previous agency you had 20 people. Do you think there is a natural limit that you can become effective before your efforts become diluted?
I think yes and no. I think firstly, it's always down to the founder and what they want in terms of where do they want the business to go. As I said, for Social Bath, going into it, we both knew as co-founders that even though we loved the idea of building a global agency, what we've really focused on is performance and profit. So I would much, and I've seen businesses do this where they have 100 employees and they're still breaking even. And yeah. I've seen businesses with 10 employees and they're making hundreds of thousands of profit a month. So for me, I want to ensure that performance is obviously top of mind and number one priority for our clients and making sure that we're ensuring that we're delivering the results. But if that requires us scaling our team to a stage where we're not making profit, then I think we need to reevaluate our business model. So I'm always going to make sure that we are being efficient with every single person's time. We have clear systems and processes in place to allow the business to scale sustainably instead of kind of burning itself out and not making enough money. So for me personally, I much prefer to have a 20-man team making really good profit, but also leave about 30% of the team's time available for new ventures that we can invest in and build ourselves and then plug into the team as if it was a client. Therefore, we can expand our company portfolio with different assets and different companies within it and raise our valuation instead of just being a service-based company that, you know, a average valuation for a service-based company is about 1.5 its annual revenue, where obviously if we build a direct consumer e-commerce brand or product, you know, the valuation is a lot higher. So that's kind of a longer term goal for us, but I'd much prefer to have a smaller, leaner team who can be way more effective than some of the global agencies that we've actually gone up against with some of our clients and outperform them because we have that kind of startup mentality and we're a little bit more kind of all hands on deck and a little bit more invested.
I hate the word pivot, but you're able to pivot a lot quicker.
Yeah, I guess adapt is a nicer way of putting
adapt,
it.
Yeah.
I think the word pivot's been used more times in the last 3 months than it's ever been used before.
I think it's on the same level as unprecedented.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's the point. It's kind of like, in our case, it's bringing in the A team and working as an extension to the existing team. You know, we look at ourselves as the kind of the rogue thinkers and the innovators. So a lot of the businesses we go into, they have existing marketing teams who do a great job as the kind of the business as usual work. But what they need kind of growth hackers, people that can come in and disrupt the model to be able to find new ways in which they can grow. And that's kind of what our core principle is. We don't want to just keep spinning the same wheel for the brands and making sure that they're making the same amount of revenue each month. We want to look at how we can scale those different opportunities, build out new commercial models for them. So it's really actually two entrepreneurs, digital entrepreneurs coming into a business and looking at how they can just implement their ideas with a team that can help activate those plans.
Is that what you'd describe you and Aaron as, two digital entrepreneurs?
I guess so, yeah.
Do you have both different skill sets? Do you have a more analytical brain, whereas Aaron's more creative?
I think it's a mix. I definitely say Aaron's background is performance marketing. He is an absolute genius when it comes to being able to drive an ROI for a brand. He is one of the best marketers I've ever met. I actually think I'm more on the kind of building brand and culture side. I'm a little bit more operationally led. I'm a lot less technical than him. He is very much kind of sitting on the kind of CMO and CTO kind of area where I would definitely be more of a COO kind of position. And that complements each other really well. Obviously, since we've been co-founders, we've now been able to kind of find ways in which we can bounce ideas and learn from each other. So I guess we're now becoming kind of very similar in terms of skill sets and what we do. But I'd definitely say he's a lot more technical than me.
So you said you're the culture guy. What is the culture at Social Buff? How would you describe it?
It's definitely kind of very lean and reactive. I'm not a big fan of hierarchy. I really want everyone to feel like they're equal and they're all kind of invested partners in the business. And
where does that come from, Will? Where does that belief in that non-belief in hierarchy come from?
I really, really didn't like hierarchy at school. You know, people demanding respect, whether that's a teacher, whether it's someone older than me. And I went to a school that was very kind of demanding of hierarchy. I was, you know, lucky enough to go to boarding school, but actually it was the worst experience I've ever had, to be honest. And I think that's where it stemmed from. I also look at kind of my parents as examples. So they're actually polar opposites. It's quite strange. So my dad is a CEO of a global company in the drinks industry. And my mum runs an equine therapy school for kids who require assisted learning. So I think the combination of those two, the kind of very kind of caring and holistic side of my mother and the kind of more business orientated side of my father, has kind of allowed me to see both perspectives and learn from them in that way. And then through personal experience, realize that actually also people don't really need managing. What they need is they need direction and they need inspiration and motivating. And I think as soon as you start treating, even if they're your employers, them as your partners or your friends or people who sit beside you trying to build that kind of vision with you, and you lead them instead of, you know, manage them, I think I just think the relationship's a lot better. And also it makes them feel more comfortable to be able to pick up the phone and say, you know, I'm not happy with this, and feel like they're not going to get told off for it. And I want just, you know, to empower a group of talented people to just do what they love without essentially the fluff and the, you know, the egos and what I see in a lot of corporate worlds as well, which I really struggle with.
Have you been exposed to that within when working with brands? The hierarchy of this is how we should do it, and if you question it, then you're in the wrong, rather than embracing that creativity.
I think we're lucky enough where we're quite selective with who we work with, and we definitely want to find partners who have the same ethos and a kind of culture. There's sometimes exceptions, and there's sometimes a lot of, you know, loopholes we have to jump through, and there's a lot of kind of relationship building. But actually, you know, we're a young and innovative team, and that's why people buy into us. But from past experience, I've definitely, you know, been exposed to a world where hierarchy and respect is demanded, even if it's not earned. And that's something that I don't like. So it's definitely a culture that I didn't want to take to, and it existed in my previous business as well slightly. So it's something that I just wanted to take away from those experiences in the past and just build something that, you know, that everyone in the business feels like it's their own business, feels like they're really working towards something together instead of for the founder, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you see Social Buff going in the next 5 to 10 years? What's the ambition? What's the plan?
I've always seen Social Buff as a stepping stone and definitely an engine to developing other brands. As much as I love running an agency, I would love to get more involved in consumer brands and products. And that's definitely kind of an area in which we are moving towards and investing in. I'm a big fan of kind of the direct consumer lifestyle space, and a lot of the brands we work with are in that space. So I would love to eventually develop products that we can, you know, sell ourselves, or, you know, even see in retail or on trade and be able to go in and see something that we've built and developed. But really, I just want to keep growing and developing great ideas and plugging that into Social Buff as an engine. Might not be Social Buff in 5 years' time, it might be something else, but always be the same team with, you know, the similar vision to be able to develop great ideas and take them to market.
And to complement that, where do you see the digital sphere going? Because I know that, for example, IGTV, they're implementing that you can flash up paid ads within IGTV.
Yeah.
Where do you see the next sort of innovation coming from? What's going to set alight the influencer market or the paid ads market, if you like?
I think at the moment we're definitely going through a bit of a transition. I actually think longer form content is just way ahead of its game in comparison to, you know, less than 5 years ago. I think there's going to be a huge amount of development in the podcasting and kind of media space for broadcasting online as well. that's kind of on the media consumption side. I think there needs to be a shift in influencer marketing in some way. I think TikTok's really delivered a very creative platform for influencers or content creators. I think influencers don't like being stigmatized with that name anymore. I think it's more about what platforms can be built to allow more creativity. And I think TikTok's kind of paving the way for that at the moment. I do think Facebook and Instagram need to change something up. I think they are a little bit kind of stagnant at the moment with the opportunity they bring for brands who don't already have the brand equity. And I think that really just means you need more disruptive kind of marketers behind the brands to find unique ways in driving these experiences. I think COVID has definitely changed a lot for us. I think a lot more people are going to, they're either going to do two things, either going to spend more time online and more time in digital, whether that's socially, whether that's through learning, whether that's through work. And then I think there's another side that's going to crave experience even more. And I think brands are going to have to adapt a lot quicker than they previously had to.
I'll be honest, I'm just seeing brands beginning to adapt to messaging and their tone now. And COVID's been with us for so long. I think there's so many adverts on telly, paid media ads, that are now shifting the message. But that should have been done weeks ago.
Well, I guess this is the great example of what hierarchy looks like and having to jump through holes. You know, you see the more challenger brands, the leaner businesses, within weeks had set up new business models to be able to adapt to the situation. They had adapted their marketing to the situation, built completely new infrastructures and strategies in which they can reach their audiences. Then the bigger conglomerates, the ones who didn't have more forward-thinking internal team members, were stagnant and they didn't do anything. And they actually cut all of their spending to retain cash flow, where really they should have been investing more than ever. But the beauty of that happening is, especially with paid social is like an auction house. So there's less people bidding for attention, meaning the cost per acquisition is lower, cost for attention is lower. So actually, it's been a great opportunity for the smaller brands to invest more in social and scale and get consumer attention. But I also think consumer attention is going to change. People are going to invest a lot more in brands that are focusing on community and culture more than just price point. And I think consumer activity is going to shift.
What brands would you pick that are doing that really well at the moment?
I think my favorite example was Gymshark. Gymshark always been a forward-thinking brand and, you know, very kind of community-led. But a great example is obviously COVID-19 hit. And one of the first initiatives that they did was they collected and rounded up as many personal trainers as possible and offered them all an hourly rate, you know, a competitive salary, essentially, to host online free live training sessions on the Gymshark platform. And I think it's that community initiative where whether they're profiting from it or not, it doesn't really matter. If they're empowering others and they're helping others and they're building foundations to kind of more opportunity for others as well. And I think the brands that don't are the ones that are going to really suffer. And Gymshark was a great example of a brand that quickly reacted to helping others before helping themselves. And, you know, when you invest in other people, there will eventually be a return in the future. And I think that's a perspective brands need to have moving forward.
That is very forward thinking. Bringing those PTs in to do free online training, but giving them a basic salary, that builds brand loyalty. And in the future, you can see those PTs supporting Gymshark because they were supported by Gymshark in the future, in the past.
Yeah.
So we're coming up to the end of the podcast, and this brings me neatly onto the last five questions. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, which leader do you look up to the most?
Yeah, and you sent me these questions prior to the podcast, and I've been stuck on this first one for a while. And I guess I guess actually the main reason why I get stuck on this is because I feel like I am influenced a lot more by people I know than people that I see online and follow. I think if you're talking about, you know, world famous leaders, I love the likes of Oprah Winfrey, what she was able to do in media and kind of build a platform for herself and also to empower others. I do spend a lot more time focusing on more kind of motivational and empowering leaders than actually people who are more kind of business led. But yeah. another one is who I admire massively is Steve Jobs. And the reason for it is, as difficult as some people might say he would have been to work with, is his motivation and, I guess, perseverance to strive for perfection every single time he released a product, I think just is a testament to people having to go above and beyond, or should go above and beyond, to strive for perfection and always, 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 you know, make sure that you do not compromise, and you make sure that you have the consumer's best experience and intentions at heart.
Do you think the customer experience from Apple has dwindled since Steve Jobs passed away?
I definitely feel like it's taking a more, I guess it's a little bit more careful approach. I think they're being a little bit less risky in what they're doing. I think Steve Jobs was a bit of a challenger within within his own company, but within the market as well. And I feel now he actually has set the foundations for Apple to kind of cruise a little. And I think yeah. they're going to need to change things up if they want to excel. And also, you know, their chief product officer left as well. I think it was last year, to set up his own agency.
Johnny Ives.
And, yeah, Johnny Ives. And I think we're probably going to see a big change in the leaders within the company over the next yeah. year or so. And that'll be interesting to see how they're able to adapt without the original kind of minds behind the brand. Yeah, but I mean, Apple is a brand that I love purely because I think their design innovation and the customer experience they always strive to achieve is undoubtedly one of the best I've ever seen. But I feel like that has been obviously the reason why Steve Jobs was so amazing. And now I think obviously the brand is falling behind slightly because of, obviously, sadly, the loss of him.
Yeah, I don't want to turn into a Steve Jobs loving, but he could see the entire picture. He could see it from the consumer's point of view, from the client's perspective. He could see how the technology would impact society. And it was that societal impact that really changed the perception of Apple.
Yeah. He wanted to be an extension of the human being. And I think that's the most important thing, is being able to be an extension and elevate people's lifestyles instead of forcing them to change their habits for you. I think that's a testament to a great product.
I think that should apply to many, many companies. And it doesn't just apply to customer experience. It applies to everything. If you can position your brand so that it becomes an extension of somebody, rather than, like you said, changing their habits or their lifestyles or changing their needs, you're instantly be able to fit with what they require, then that's your position in your brand to become part of their life.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
What did you want to be when you grew up, Will?
It changed a lot, to be honest. I wasn't really one of those people, and I still don't know what I want to be. I kind of just have always chased the things that interested me and whatever made me happy, I was kind of invested in that at the time. I think the first thing that when I really knew I wanted to do something and had a goal set was when I was at school, I wanted to be a professional rugby player. And I got fairly close, but I just wasn't committed enough. But it did teach me kind of discipline and hard work. And I actually had to make a very drastic kind of career change. And that's what led me to film. It was just something else that I was really interested in, and something that I loved creativity. I was always very creative, and film was kind of the next stepping stone for that. So I actually pivoted from sport to filmmaking, and that's how I ended up going to film school. It was kind of my second option. And that's really been it. It's really whatever's interests me. You know, I never planned to be an entrepreneur or a business owner. It just, I kind of like to go over the flow a bit, and you know, I commit to what I want to start, and I want to see it through, and I commit to that as much as I can. But I think I am very kind of bigger picture minded. So a lot of my thoughts are based around new ideas and what those ideas could become. And I guess that's the typical issue with entrepreneurs, is having too many ideas and not being able to follow through.
They're like
on
magpies.
Them.
They want everything shiny.
Yeah, pretty much. So I've kind of just chased anything that's interested me. I'm a lot more grounded than I was when I first started, when I thought I could do everything at once. So I think now patience has definitely been something that I've recognised as actually a strength instead of a weakness.
Yeah, yeah. What would be the worst job that you could ever do and why?
I would probably say a politician. And
current climate, yeah.
Yeah, I had a short kind of stint as a youth advisor to an MP for a bit, and I got to experience what the world of politics was like from an internal perspective. And I think the biggest frustration is there's a lot you want to achieve and there's a lot of hurdles you have to jump over to achieve it. And I think it's a very kind of traditional way of thinking, and I think it's not very kind of forward thinking and innovative. And I feel like I would probably get bored very quickly or very frustrated because I would have kept on being told no. And I think politics is obviously such an important area for the economy, as well as obviously our personal livelihoods. But when I experienced it from an internal perspective, I actually was very unimpressed with how it was managed and run. And it's a bit of an eye-opener how the country is run as well.
It does appear to be very inefficient.
Yeah.
A lot of wastage.
Yeah, absolutely. And when things are then decided on, it takes forever for them to be implemented, which is even more frustrating.
Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn?
Tough one. I am a big fan of Instagram, actually, for mainly for networking. I DM people on a daily basis for business or just relationship building. And I find it really effective because you can kind of get through that kind of gatekeeper and barrier that more traditional methods like cold emailing or LinkedIn messaging is. It's a lot easier to find a founder of a big company on Instagram who has 100 followers and DMing them instead of going to their LinkedIn when they have 30,000 followers. But I'm really enjoying LinkedIn at the moment. I think the organic reach is incredible. I think it's a great place to invest in longer term. And I think LinkedIn, obviously not being influenced by its, well, not even its competitors, but other social media platforms, is allowing it to really pave its own way in a more kind of authentic and organic way. I just hope that they don't go down the route of Instagram and Facebook and reduce, obviously, the opportunity of organic reach. And I think it has a huge opportunity to be a great content platform for learning and networking and growing. So for me, that's where I'm investing pretty much all my time in at the moment.
Mine are Instagram and LinkedIn for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And then the final question on the podcast, Will, is what was the last book that you read?
I've actually read quite a few books I haven't finished. So the last book that I read and finished and really loved was actually David Goggins' Can't Hurt Me. I try not to consume too many books that tell me how to run a business or, you know, tell me how to make great investments, that kind of stuff, because I feel like eventually you then overconsume with opinion. But what I love about reading is the psychology books that I can find. So David Goggins was amazing. Just the true, the true sentiment of mind over matter. And I just thought to be able to unlock your brain in which he's been able to achieve what he's achieved, I think is incredible. And I really love reading books about people's journeys and how they overcame challenges, and it's very motivational. So yeah, that was definitely the last book I read and finished properly without kind of making notes and coming back to it every so often. And it was amazing, really good read. Highly recommend it.
I will. I'll check it out. Thanks, Will.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Whoa. Don't go anywhere yet. Julio, tell people where they can get more information.
If you like the podcast, go visit saleschange.co.uk.
That's good, but you said .do.
Saleschange.co.uk. Why don't you head... No. It's bad. It's bad. Go to saleschange.co.uk and... saleschange.co.uk and subscribe to our incredible newsletter. Thanks for listening.